I'm Jake Davidson, Associate Editor of the Bridgewater Daily Observations, and I'm here with Jim Haskell, the Editor of the BDO, and we have a really special podcast today that I think our listeners will enjoy. We're joined by Thomas L. Friedman. He's the Foreign Affairs Columnist for the New York Times. Tom is also a best-selling author, and he is here due to a unique set of circumstances. So, Jim, maybe you can explain how this all came together.
Yeah, well, Jake, Tom and I are longtime friends of almost 25 years, back to the 1990s when we first started talking to each other about emerging economies and markets. And he was writing a book called The Lexus and the Olive Tree at the time. And then from time to time, Tom will call me and just sort of get an update of what I'm thinking about markets. But this call was a little bit different. It had a little bit more urgency to it. He specifically wanted to talk about energy markets and some of the issues that we're seeing in those markets. You know, as our listeners know, you've had a huge surge in demand for energy that's overwhelmed supply, particularly in Europe and China. And the result has been surging natural gas prices, carbon prices, and electricity prices. And we've seen electricity rationing in China itself. So Tom wanted to talk about these energy issues because he's starting to connect dots, looking at these outcomes and thinking that sort of the tectonic plates of geopolitics are beginning to change, and wanted to understand the root cause of these price changes and whether they'd be temporary or more sustained. In fact, so much so that he published an article last night that's linked to New York Times, and we're going to link it here again. So it's in this podcast. And so I thought that the really interesting thing to do with Tom is, instead of just putting him together with our commodity team, which is Andrew Foote and Carrie Riley, we also wanted to bring in our sustainability CIO, Karen Carnial-Tambor. Instead of just putting them together, let's let him ask the questions to that team, and then let's hear him talk about what he sees as the repercussions in geopolitics. And together, that would be a really interesting conversation and content for our listeners and readers to hear and read.
And it's crazy how quickly it all came together. I think I got the call from you around noon that this was happening and that we were recording about an hour later. So you'll hear Tom from his car. You'll hear Karen from the Toronto airport. So we apologize for the audio quality, but I think the conversation is so great and it's really worth it.
I totally agree. And so with that, let's get right to the podcast. Hey, Tom, how are you?
I'm just great. And can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can hear you just fine. So I think what we'll do, Tom, is have our team discuss the dynamics we're seeing around the energy crunch. And then we'd love to get your thoughts on how you're seeing them and how they relate to the geostrategic issues you were talking to me about. So Karen, let's start with you. You wrote a Bridgewater Daily Observations recently describing some of the drivers of the higher energy prices. Can you explain how that's working?
So Tom, thanks so much for being here. It's really exciting to talk to you. You know, an important thing that's happening in energy markets is that the fact that all around the world, pretty much every country and every policymaker has signed on to this idea that we need to make progress toward net zero and reduce our carbon footprint is finally actually having an impact on the markets, because policies are actually being put in place to help and achieve that. Now, those policies aren't really happening in a top-down coordinated way. And there's a lot of different ways that you could, in theory, transition away from, you know, energy that emits greenhouse gases to other types of energy. But the way we're currently pursuing in this sort of uncoordinated way is a particularly inflationary one. And that's why you're ending up with all these price rises. So in particular, there's a lot of ways to do this, but one way you can do it is price carbon. So tell people, well, it's actually more expensive now to use oil, natural gas, particularly coal. And the idea is that that gets people to use less of it and encourages people to invest in greener things. Europe's leading the world in doing that. And so what's happening in Europe is exactly what you'd expect, which is every electricity provider now needs to pay for all the carbon. So they're dying to get out of their most expensive ways of producing electricity. And natural gas is kind of a transition place where, you know, renewables are not yet ready to be the entire menu of how you have energy. We haven't invested enough to make them workable and scalable enough. And so natural gas somewhere in the middle, better than coal. So there's a huge squeeze on those. So that's pricing it. The other thing you can do is you can literally just go to the supply side and say, guess what? No more of that. We're just going to limit the supply side. We're seeing that in a lot of places. You know, in rich countries, it looks more like developed world investors in the US and Europe saying, I'm not going to finance a new coal plant. I'm not interested. So just underinvestment in that supply. And then of course, China does it in an even more top-down way, calls people and says, no more, actually, you can't use any more power. We don't want that. Most of our power is coal and we don't want that. So if you try to transition by basically limiting the supply or making it expensive, you're going to get price rises. You're going to get inflationary effects. There are other ways to transition that we could have pursued and that people have looked at. And of course, there's the magic of getting just better technology that, you know, gets everyone to shift away from these things. But that's not really the path we're on. And so you're seeing these sort of inflationary kind of spirals of supply squeezes that happen. And from our perspective, we see a very long period of underinvestment in getting a lot of these energy sources online. So there's only so much that can be brought online quickly. You got a little bit of Saudi capacity, you got some shale, but there's only so much can be brought online quickly and a lot of squeezes.
Fascinating. It's like we're going green, but way too fast than we have the alternatives, even the bridge fuels in place.
A really interesting angle here, Tom, we're talking about is that pretty much every central bank, regular bank, investor in the world has been told to go stress test their portfolio for what will happen if we transition away from carbon. So do, you know, climate stress tests. And the way most people have understood that is to say, well, one day we won't need any more oil, natural gas, coal. So that must mean it'll be worthless. So let me look at my portfolio, see what happens if it falls to very low levels. Oh, that's bad. So I should get out of those things. And that may be true in a very long term, but in the short term, it really depends how you get there to that transition. And if you get there through this way, then for long periods of time, those things can actually rise in price.
I think Karen gave nice backdrop. The only additive point I would make is that we're trying to engineer a total transition of the transport economy by policy, by mandate. And that's not what we're used to doing. First of all, the last time we did something like this was 120 years ago when we switched from the universal use of horsepower to automobiles, cars, and trucks. And that evolved organically, purely through price signals. And that doesn't mean that the shift from horsepower to internal combustion engines didn't get policy support. The government's paid for roads and things like that. In the end, the decision that the individual homeowner made, the individual driver made in switching from a horse to a car was driven by quality, comfort, and price, and the net economics. And this time we're trying to do something that's really quite different. It's large in scope, and we're trying to enforce it, and that's creating lots of frictions and challenges. So I think that's a really great starting point. That's the first line of attack or the first angle to think of this conceptually. And then the second angle is that what we're seeing in the natural gas market, what we're seeing in coal, what we're seeing in electricity prices is just the simple, plain old workings of the commodity cycle. And Karen alluded to this, and the roots are deeper than just price. But if you look at the price trajectory that the oil market took 2014 through 2019, investing in hydrocarbons was bad. Bad returns, bad prices. And that has a consequence on the way people approach the space, not just the investors, but the companies that dig the stuff out of the ground. So we had an extended period of bad prices, bad returns. And that has an effect on the way the companies behave. It takes years to reverse those consequences. And in on the tail end of that, something that was already a normal commodity cycle, you had the pandemic.
And the pandemic sends extremely low prices, supply destroying levels of price in all commodities, everything from natural gas to oil.
But the suppression of the demand, the goods demand, didn't stay down for very long. In fact, it came roaring back. But the implication and the significance of the low prices on the supply continues to endure. So now we have a mismatch, what would have been a mismatch between supply and demand, even if the commodity cycle had been allowed to evolve naturally, has yet again been amplified.
It makes total sense to me what Karen and Andrew is saying, that which is that you had kind of a secular trend of that disincentivized investment in not only sort of dirty fuels, but I would say bridge fuels as well, like natural gas. Then you had a pandemic which crushed demand. So that also made investing in these commodities really dangerous and unhealthy. And then suddenly you get a snapback in demand, and this secular and short-term pandemic, you know, shaped market, the supply just isn't there. And that kind of sets the table for what I see as having a really important geopolitical side effect.
I was just going to add that the other, partly a geopolitical thing, but certainly a political thing, that during this snapback from COVID, you are having at the same time a lot of acceleration in policymakers wanting to prove their climate credentials, if you will. You know, Europe has been on a long plan to pick up kind of how tight the carbon cap and trade is. And it certainly it's picking up. So more people need to do it, need to pay for carbon. They're making that tighter and tighter to reduce emissions. And then China, I think, has surprised a lot of people with how hard it has kind of pushed towards that in the last very recent period. So that just adds to the supply squeeze at the same time.
Carrie, is there anything you would add to this story on the interconnectedness between energy markets? Like how China squeezes coal, so they need more natural gas, and then you squeeze Europe on natural gas and sort of the interconnectivity of all that.
The connections between the oil market and the natural gas market are actually pretty separate with only a little bit of overlap, but natural gas and coal are quite connected. And natural gas historically has always been a regional market with very little ability to transport gas around the world. And that's changing slowly with LNG. But natural gas is competing directly with coal in electricity generation. And so one of the things driving natural gas prices higher is the fact that China has cut back on coal production. And so there's less coal, and so they're having to bid up LNG. And LNG is only a small percentage of world natural gas. And so it's a relatively small market, and Asia and Europe are both competing for LNG. And a regional market like that with only small ability to transport gas from one place to another is very prone to extreme spikes in price. The US has a ton of natural gas over the long term and no ability to get it out. So if natural gas were a global market like oil, where you could easily send shale gas from the United States to the rest of the world, there would have been a lot more investment in natural gas production in the US, and there would be less extreme regional spikes in price. The US natural gas price is a third of what it is in Europe and Asia. And there's no real ability to get it there without huge capital expenditures in LNG terminals that there's recently a pickup in appetite for, but take years to complete.
Tom, we've talked about our expertise on the economic drivers of higher energy prices, but now what I want to do is pivot to your expertise and talk about the implications of this energy squeeze on some of the geopolitical hotspots you've been following. You know, I know one thing that you were talking to me about is how this imbalance in the supply and demand for energy is going to impact the Iran talks.
Well, you know, what I say is this all is going to come to a head in the negotiations between the United States, Europe, Russia, China, and Iran over whether to resume the Iran nuclear deal. So just a quick bit of history. Trump comes in and he very quickly tears up the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal that Obama struck, that basically put a cap on Iran's ability to process uranium in sufficient quantity to produce a bomb for 15 years, out to 2030, basically. And if it tried to do so, we would have a year's time ahead of it to see any breakout. That was the basic guts of the deal. We'd have a year breakout vision, and the deal would last till 2030. So Trump tears up the deal and reimposes economic sanctions on Iran. The first Iranians don't do anything. They try to see if they can negotiate their way back from this. But then they eventually decide to call Trump's bluff. And what they do is they start lashing out regionally, and they send 20-some drones to attack Abqaiq, Saudi Arabia's one of its largest gas and oil processing centers, barely disguised as coming from Iran. And we don't retaliate. Trump doesn't retaliate, basically saying to the Saudis, you know, that's their problem. We eventually send some Patriot missile batteries that we charge the Saudis money for. And so the Iranians, you know, observe all of this. They also lash out against our forces in Iraq, and they use Yemen as a base to also launch attacks on Saudi Arabia. But then they opt to another plan. They basically begin spinning their centrifuges again and begin processing uranium up to 20%. In the last few months, they've taken it up to 60%, which is just a very short leap up to weapons grade from 60%. It is the assessment of the U.S. government right now that Iran may be 6 weeks to 2 months away from having sufficient uranium to build a single bomb. Now, it would take them a year to a year and a half, we believe, for them to have a warhead to deliver this. But they are getting extremely close to having enough uranium to build a warhead. And so the whole purpose of the Iran nuclear deal, which was to give us a year's visibility ahead of time, is collapsing before our very eyes. Iran has a new government, was just elected. The old negotiating team was thrown out, and they've basically been stalling in the talks in Vienna. And what is the growing consensus here, I would say, in Washington, is that Iran wants to make itself a threshold nuclear power like Japan. Oh, we don't have a bomb, but with a few turn of the screws, we could have a bomb. And the Israelis are not going to let that happen, I suspect, or make clear they will take steps to make sure that doesn't happen. And it's implied that the United States would do so as well to some degree. Now, the Biden team is still trying to get the Iranians back to the negotiating table to somehow go back to the old JCPOA, but that's almost not possible anymore. Now you'd have to have a situation where you'd have to get the Iranians to give up all the nuclear fissile material they've already processed. So all of this is coming to a head, you know, while we're focused here basically on these various bills in Congress. We think we got out of the Middle East because we got out of Afghanistan. We are not interested in the Middle East anymore, but the Middle East is interested in us. And basically, if Iran, you know, crosses this threshold, and this could come very quickly, Israel and the United States would be very tempted to act in some way if there is no alternative. And if they were to act against Iran in the middle of a global oil and gas crisis, Iran is now producing about 1 million barrels a day, which they're selling to China, which desperately now needs that 1 million barrels a day. I can only imagine what would happen to global oil prices. So in a really funny way, you know, in a really unexpected way, the Iranians have really turned the table. I think they're in a much stronger position right now. The Chinese, the last thing they want is us to attack there. I think the Israelis, Americans, everyone who wanted that Iran nuclear deal to cap their program is feeling really regretful that Donald Trump tore up that deal, because it's going to be very difficult to get back there, and it's going to be very difficult to put pressure on Iran. That's sort of a general way I look at it.
And staring beyond Iran, do you see repercussions for some of the other big actors in the region or even in Europe?
Yeah, if you're Vladimir Putin now, oh my God, you know, you can sit in Moscow and tell every EU country, see that box over there, you take a number, you wait in line, and I'll decide, you know, who I want to sell my oil and gas to more. And Lord knows, you know, what kind of demands he might impose. And so from an era where these commodity suppliers were on their backs, you know, they're really going to be in much stronger geopolitical positions now. And India, which seemed to be coming back in some way, I think is really also going to be damaged by this. It's a country that depends on coal and imported oil, and it's going to get caught in a pincer between, you know, China and Russia in some way. So that just as another big power that will be really, you know, hammered by this. Now, eventually the market will, supply and demand will normalize. People will start investing in natural gas again. But for the reasons that you guys stated, you know, the way the natural gas, if natural gas is our bridge fuel, but it's a bridge fuel that's very hard to export globally like oil and gas, we're in for a real secular move here on prices, because that's not easily normalized. And the only other giant producer is Russia. So I just think we're in a really interesting, tricky moment, and the first shall become last and the last shall become first.
Kerry, you're very close to the oil markets. Do you have any thoughts on what Tom just said?
So I have a couple of thoughts on that. The first is, in terms of Russia and natural gas, I totally agree with you. I think that Putin really has Europe in a bind with natural gas. On the oil market, I kind of disagree with your take. And so it would be interesting to go back and forth. The really important thing to keep in mind with the oil market is that in the last decade, the power dynamics, I think, have totally changed. And for two reasons that are kind of secular and one that is particular to today. The secular reasons are the emergence of U.S. shale and the fact that the U.S. is now more or less self-sufficient in oil, a dramatic change from a decade ago. And U.S. shale is also pretty different than sources of oil were historically, in the sense that it can be ramped up a lot more quickly. It's sort of short term. You do an investment and you drill the wells and you get it and they decline quickly. And then the reason particular to today is that you still have world oil demand 2 or 3% below pre-COVID levels, largely as a result of air travel and transportation still being kind of depressed. I'm not sure that the U.S. is ever going to fight another war over oil. It's very, very different than a decade ago. And I think that the oil market would be much more able to respond to a short-term disruption today because of the combination of spare capacity in Saudi Arabia and Russia and other countries, that are still producing below pre-COVID levels, as well as the fact that U.S. shale could ramp up fairly quickly. And then with the whole backdrop from a narrow United States perspective, this isn't true for most other developed countries, but from a narrow United States perspective, we're self-sufficient in oil and no longer dependent on the Middle East as a source of oil.
So that's a really great analysis. Can I just push back on one thing? I think that is true for U.S., but our partners in the JCPOA, in the Iran nuclear deal, are a Germany, France, the UK, China, and Russia. And they are more dependent on Middle Eastern oil. And it's true the Iranians wouldn't have leverage on us, but we have to think about the effects of any actions we take on these other economies.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think it's a little bit different. Certainly the self-sufficiency in oil is a United States particular thing. I think it would be interesting to see, U.S. oil supply was growing at 2 million barrels a day, and then COVID hit. And all the U.S. oil companies have sort of gotten religion of now we're not investing more, we're returning money to shareholders. But I think there's a real question of how much higher oil prices would need to be for them to change that tune and how quickly they could do it. Because on a lot of the measures they publish, actually, shale companies reinvesting would be pretty profitable, even with oil at 75 to 80, where it is today. If you had oil prices go up much more, I think you would all of a sudden have U.S. shale companies scrambling to drill new wells. And it's different than deep water oil production, where it takes years to develop. I think it could start ramping up a lot more quickly. And like I said, you still have a little bit of cushion from other suppliers.
I guess all I'm simply saying is that in a context of, say, 3 years ago when we were negotiating with Iran, and it was an economic basket case with no cards in its hand, so desperate that it had to launch a drone attack against Saudi Arabia, which is quite remarkable when you think about it. I would say the tables have turned now, just from a negotiating point of view. They're getting close to enough weapons-grade material to be a threshold nuclear power, which is all they really want to be, because they just want, that gives them the influence they need in the area. And suddenly their oil becomes in much higher demand. And therefore, if you target them, even the short-term effect on the oil market of a violent kinetic action in the Persian Gulf, it can be pretty severe. That's really all I'm saying. I wouldn't take it any farther than that, but I'm just saying, from an Iranian point of view, this really rapid restructuring of the price signals in the global, oil, gas, coal commodity market, if you compare it to where they were 4 years ago and where they are now, they're in a much stronger position.
I want to make sure to open the line here to other members of our team. So Andrew, Jake, Karen, do you have any questions for Tom?
I have two questions for Tom. One is that Russia has tremendous power right now. The gas inventories in Europe are low. Europe's reliance on Russia is high. But one of the little idiosyncrasies behind Europe being short on gas today is the public blowback against nuclear power that has developed in the UK and in Germany. And the strong commitment both those countries have made to not investing in new capacity and mothballing the existing capacity. And on a global level, nuclear power is not that important, but within those two economies, it is. So there's two parts of my question. First, if Putin overplays his hand, is there a scenario where the public perception of nuclear power is rethought and we can reverse engines on the decline of the nuclear power in Germany and the UK? Or is that too much to ask? And the second level to that question is, how much do you think Vladimir Putin is thinking ahead that if I overplay my hand in calendar year 2022 and I squeeze these markets too much, I actually wind up hastening I amplify the price signal, sure, and I wind up hastening the transition to a carbon-free economy?
So a really good question. I would just say this. So I have a general rule in life is if you're a green and you aren't in favor of a carbon tax or nuclear power, you're not serious. To me, those are the tests of seriousness, because a carbon-free world is a scale problem. It's a scale problem. And if you don't have scale, you have a hobby. I like hobbies. I used to build model airplanes as a kid. I wouldn't try to mitigate climate change as a hobby. And that's all you've got when you're relying just on wind, solar, and hydro. So I just don't see it happening without that. The problem, and where Putin has a much stronger position, is that once you shut down nuclear, it's not like ramping up a shale oil, you know, facility. And building a nuclear plant is become a 10-year bet the business proposition. I mean, a 1 gig nuclear power plant will cost you $10-12 billion. So I see Putin in the driver's seat, you know, here for at least the near term, for sure. And I don't think he's so worried about, you know, creating the price signal to rapidly get an alternative. He has to worry about that in the long run. But I think he's bought himself some real time here.
Tom, just to follow up on the politics of energy that Andrew raised, obviously, green parties have become ascendant in Europe and climate change has become a big political issue across the world. And how do you think those parties and the general political issue of climate change is going to evolve if you see the kind of price moves that we're seeing right now?
It's going to take a real hit, because if you do get the kind of winter where people literally don't have fuel, where you get that situation in Texas that we had where people just couldn't get electricity, but you get that in big urban areas in Europe, the Greens are going to have hell to pay. I think what Merkel did in shutting down Germany's nuclear industry will be seen in time as just one of the most huge reckless things that we've done anywhere. Because yes, they did a great thing in driving down the price of solar with their feed-in tariff, but my God, when you start shutting down nuclear capacity right now for ideological reasons, capacity that had a long record of safety, I think that is not going to look good on her in her bio.
And then in the U.S., you know, green infrastructure is also a big priority for Democrats right now. Do you think the energy squeeze we're seeing will impact the shape of that debate at all going forward?
A very interesting question. You know, I mean, it's just, you know, my whole approach, this whole question, which is in my book, Hot, Flat, and Proud, which I wrote in 2008, is that there's only one thing big and powerful as Mother Nature, and that is Father Greed, the market. And if you want to take on Mother Nature, what you have to do is incentivize the market with the right taxes, price signals, you know, regulations to produce clean, green energy over time. And that has to be every form of it, whether it's through nuclear, wind, solar, hydro, biomass, wave, whatever it is. And one of the great weaknesses of the green movement is that they always, there's a bias toward spending money, you know what I mean, that we're going to pay for this and not simply getting the right price signal in place and letting the market respond. But you have to also give the market the time to do it at the speed, scope, and scale we need. And I think there's been a mismatch on that. And that's one of the things we're paying for now, that people just kind of overreacting and ESG everything before we really had the infrastructure in place to make this transition in a stable way. And the Texas incident was very important because that's where Mother Nature met the market. That was an extreme weather event. And there's every reason to believe we'll have more extreme weather events. But it was one we don't think of. I always remember, we're not having global warming. We're having global weirding. Global weirding is what you get when the climate changes, not global warming. And global weirding means the hots get hotter, the wets get wetter, the dries get drier, and the colds get colder. You get all these different extremes. So you could get all kinds of crazy stuff happening. I just think you need a resilient grid and a resilient menu of greening options. But if it doesn't include nuclear and gas, you're just not going to get there. And this could, the question you're raising, let me put it in its crudest form, could we really get a backlash to green parties and green movements? I tell you, people are freezing this winter. And I'm going to Glasgow, the global climate conference. And if they have blackouts at the global climate conference, that is going to be the headline.
Tom, quick question for you. I love how you're describing this. I think you're spot on in describing what needs to be done. Do you have any insights? I know you talked to a lot of people all around the world, but in the US in particular, how likely we are to get anything sensible down this path of kind of taming the market in this direction? It feels like a lot of the desire and ambition that the Biden folks had on climate is kind of being watered down to not much as far as I could tell, or at least not the stuff that's expensive, like taxing carbon versus cheap, like I'll spend money to refurbish some building.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's why I say, Karen, you're really not serious in my book if you're not for a carbon tax. I think if you're not for a gasoline tax, and if you're not for nuclear power, if you're for all the easy stuff. You know, one of my rules of life is if it isn't boring, it isn't green. If it isn't boring, it isn't green. Everyone wants to be Al Gore. I want to be Al Gore. I want to win an Oscar. I want to win an Emmy. I want to win a Nobel Prize. I want to walk in bars and have all kinds of people come up and flock me for autographs. The problem is, and Al Gore is a wonderful hero of this movement, but the green movement in too many cases is, I tweeted about it, the real heroes of the green movement are people like this guy at NRDC who figured out how you cut the energy use of a Coke dispensing machine or a soda pop dispensing machine by 50%. But to do that, you actually have to understand the engineering of a Coke machine, and you have to understand the engineering of how it interfaces with the public electricity utility. And there is no more boring institution on God's green earth than a public electricity utility. But it's the people who get in there who really know this kind of stuff and really ready to do the boring stuff, not the I got my college to disinvest in Exxon, that actually doesn't move the needle. And so, I sometimes get very frustrated with that. It's just this kind of easy green. None of this is easy, and it takes the market. And if you have a green movement that comes out of a political strain that is basically hostile to markets and hostile to innovators and hostile to risk takers, you have a real mismatch.
Tom, thanks so much for joining us. That was a really great conversation.
Jim, thanks so much. Karen, Andrew, Carrie, this was fantastic. Let's do this again real soon.